The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I'm going to attempt to talk about my years of training with Reverend Master Jiyu, and I want to, I hope that I can paint a true picture of what it was like to train with her. And of course, it's from my own perspective. And I was a mess when I came, and I often misinterpreted what she was trying to do with me and misunderstood. And but I think I think I can give you some idea of what it was like. Reverend Master wrote in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom a mantra which appears at the beginning and the end of the first part of the book. And it says, "The treasure house exists. When the Lord of the house permits me to hold the jewel, I must do so with awe and reverence. I must hold it so that each facet is distinct. I should not show this jewel idly to those still caught in fame and gain, who may consider or weigh its worth, but I show it anyway." And I think that, for me, describes Reverend Master Jiyu, that she gave her teaching freely, and some people rejected it and gave her a difficult time, but she still showed it. Now, the facet of the jewel that I really needed to see and which I saw, and it's hard to describe, but it was that she was real. She was genuine. This isn't a very Buddhist term, but she was the real thing. She had found the truth. And as far as I could tell, she was living it completely and wholeheartedly. And I saw in her the love and compassion of the unborn. And in growing up, for me, it felt like nothing was real, that my family, everything was pretending, and that it wasn't okay to be real. And I didn't see any real compassion. So this was really important for me and a part of my koan to know that this existed. And I clearly saw it in her. And I'm deeply grateful that I was her disciple, that I had the many years that I had to train with her. And although I had a great deal of difficulty training with her, it's actually where I feel her presence now that I feel most safe. And I go to the Founder Shrine here at the Abbey and at Compassionate Friend Hermitage and out to her stupa when I'm having some difficult things arising, because I sense her big heart. I can connect to her big heart and her compassion, and what she taught us. And that helps me a lot. Also, in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, Reverend Master, as you know, talks about past lives. And one of her past lives that she said was the source of her koan was the life of a white tiger. Where is this? Oh, I see. She calls it the source of the koan. And I'm just going to read one small section because this will help describe what I'm talking about in her being real and what I needed to see. For those of you who may not have read this, she experienced the life of a tiger who lived 3,000 years ago, who was captured because they had a cult of tiger worship, and was put in a cage where he went into despair and she, when she experiences this life and experiences the despair, she says, "Oh, sweet tiger, dying in this dungeon hole, all you ever wanted to be was a tiger, nothing more. But these men in their ignorance thought you had power. They wanted it from you and so destroyed your youth and life. You just wanted to be you, the you you knew you were. You had no wish to be a god. Now indeed I know the source of my koan and why my legs have retained the memory of your pain. For all my life I have wanted to be a simple monk. High places and great names are not for me, and yet the world has denied me this right. When I at last went to the east, no one would believe that this was all I asked. And so the reporters came in droves to interview and photograph, and I was sent here and there to be stared at and discussed, and all the time my heart bled, for all I wished was to be a monk. And all you wished was to be a tiger. You could no more understand why they should want you than I could understand why my family and the reporters did what they did. For us, it was so very simple. We wanted to be what we knew we were and not to be made over into what others wanted us to be." And I believe this is what we all truly long for, to be who we really are. And I know that I did and I do. And in doing this practice, we're training to become who we really are. And part of it is to know the unborn, to live from that place that Reverend Master Jiyu talks about and found, but also just to be ourselves, who we are, our ordinariness, our the difficulties that we have, the personalities that we have. We train ourselves, but we never become something other than we are, and we can accept that. And be that. And this is an important thing that I learned throughout the years of my training, was to just accept who I was and do my best within that. My notes are all confused. I've got them all written all over the place. As you've heard many times before, she was very generous in her offering of the teaching. She told us what we needed to find, needed to do to find what she found. We had to give up our attachment to everything. And we had to be willing to say yes. And when people complained, she would say, "I don't make the rules." And she talked about the importance of saying yes to the master, and to the schedule and to everything. It was so that we could say yes to the eternal. It wasn't so that she could get everything her way, but that we could let go of our ideas of what we wanted to do, how things should be done, and just say yes, be willing, to be willing to let go of the self, which causes our suffering, as we all know, and to say yes to something deeper, which is the cessation of suffering. But it's not easy, as we all know. And in the early days, here at the monastery, you had to say yes to a lot because nothing ever remained the same. The schedule was always changing. We tried getting up before 45 minutes before dawn, so we'd be up sometimes at 3:30 and sometimes at 4. She tried a schedule of 4:30 rising where you had meditation and morning service and then community working meditation and then temple cleanup and then breakfast. So things were always changing. Suddenly there'd be a Dharma talk. Things would sometimes be late. She wasn't manipulating this. She was just trying to do the best she could. But it was very helpful just to drop our opinions and just do whatever was happening. And to say yes to her when she wanted something to be done and when she wanted it done in a certain way, to just say yes to that. And this is what those of you who train here with us from time to time can also learn from the schedule that we have and the work that you do, is just to do whatever the schedule is, to do whatever work you're assigned to do, to chop the carrots in the way the cook wants it, to look at what your mind is doing when you don't get what you want. This is saying yes to the eternal. And you can do this in your daily lives outside of the monastery as well by responding to what is good to do and not what you want to do necessarily. To get up each morning and meditate, even when you're tired or don't see any point. This is saying yes and trusting. Trusting in the teaching, trusting in the Buddha nature within all beings. Now, having said all this, I had great difficulty training with Reverend Master. My memory could be wrong, but my memory is that she would say that when a master gets his or herself out of the way, that she or he becomes like a mirror to the disciple. And that we see ourselves reflected in that mirror. So the fears we have, the angers that we have, we put all these things on our master, and yet it's really coming from ourselves. And I kept a diary, kind of a steady diary, for many, many years, and now I keep it from time to time. But in going back and reading it, later, many years after she had died, I saw how I had always complained about her, not always, but often, complained about her, judged her, thought that she hated me, thought that she was mistreating me, thought that she was judging me. And in looking at the diaries from a distance, I saw that she was so incredibly kind, and she was trying to help me in so many different ways, and I just didn't see it. I was too caught up in my suffering and my problems, in what I thought she should be treating me, and she was trying to just get me to see the truth, to do my training, and I know that she did get annoyed with me from time to time and grouched about me, and sometimes I heard this. But I can really understand why now, and that she was a human being, and we were very difficult, and she needed to just let it out from time to time. How did I meet Reverend Master? I know for all of us it was different. I was living in Eugene, Oregon, between 1970 and 1971 and 72. And I was really searching for something. I was desperate. I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I was looking in all kinds of other directions. And when I mentioned to a friend of mine that what was going on with me, she suggested I write to the Abbey. And interestingly enough, she had heard about the Abbey from Reverend Master Daizui, who was living in Eugene at the time and was going to school and also offering counseling. And he was her counselor. So she had been here for a month and told me about the Abbey, and I wrote about what was going on with me, and I was invited to come up. And I came for a weekend. It was a non-retreat weekend. I had no idea about Shasta Abbey Buddhism, Reverend Master Jiyu. And during that weekend, I might have been the only lay trainee, I can't remember, but everybody was invited to a Dharma talk that she was giving in one of the small rooms in our Sangha house. It was an informal talk. And so I was there, this completely raw new lay person. And I think I sensed that there was really something very deep going on with her. And I don't know if I understood what she was saying, but I felt like this is the only way I can describe it, is entered another level of consciousness that I hadn't known before. And I came back a few more times and then stayed and was ordained within a year in September of 1973 with Reverend Master Daizui and another monk. And I was quite surprised when I asked her if I could become a monk, and she just said yes. I thought you had to ask three times, but she just said yes, and I became a monk. And I'm very grateful, very, very grateful that I did. For me, it saved my life, saved my spiritual life. And she, I was very difficult. And I'm not saying that in a judgmental way, but I was truly a mess. And so she really tried to help me in many, many different ways. I remember her giving me a mantra to recite, which generally wasn't done here, to recite continuously throughout the day, all day long. And I did it until she thought it was time to stop. And the mantra was, "The goose is out." And there's a story of a goose being in a bottle, and suddenly it's out, and the bottle isn't broken, and how did the goose get out? So, and of course this reflects then training. And so I recited, "The goose is out," all day long. She also allowed me to do my own private retreat early on. I think it was in 74, actually, when I was having difficulty. I asked her if I could. At some point during the retreat, she had me sit round the clock without moving. And she also had a monk sitting outside the shrine. It was in the Kanzeon, what was then the Kanzeon shrine. She had a different monk sitting out there the whole time I was there in case I needed something. It was just incredibly kind and really trying to help. In 1975, I was thinking of leaving. I was full of doubts. And when she heard about this, she actually asked me to leave. And she told me, she said, "I have faith in you, but until you have faith in yourself, you won't get anywhere. You need to have faith in yourself." And it was very interesting because as soon as I left, I had faith in the monastery. Everything I was doubting was gone, and I just wanted to come back. But I knew I couldn't come back until I had faith in myself. So that was her wonderful teaching to me. And I spent a lot of time meditating, just all day long at some point. And I kept a diary. I was actually living at the YWCA, because that's all I could afford. And eventually I moved to the Priory, the Berkeley Priory. And one time when she was coming down there, she was glad to see me and invited me to some talks she was giving. And I gave her my diary. And when she got back to the Abbey and read the diary, she called me and said, "Come back." So I guess I had learned what I needed to learn. And I think this was one of the greatest teachings that she gave me and all of us, her incredible faith in all of us that we could do this practice. She did not think that she was anything special, that she was any different than us. When I said I felt inadequate, she said, "So do I." Which, of course, I didn't believe. but to tell me that I had to have faith in myself and all of us, she saw the Buddha nature in all of us, and she told us that we could do it, that she wouldn't do it for us. She couldn't. And she wouldn't. And although she pointed the way over and over again, she said we had to do the running. And she never let us depend on her in that way. And two other times when I was in need of help, she allowed me to do retreats here, to do private retreats, once for 3 weeks and once for 8 days. Which also helped enormously. And whenever I made some progress in training, whenever I opened up, she was delighted. She gave me a hard time. She grouched about me. But when she saw my successes, she was really happy. And she tried to get me to look up. I think she tried to get all of us to look up. The first time my mother came to visit when I was a new monk, she met with my mother and she said, "Most people go through hell looking up, and your daughter goes through heaven looking down." And all of us know how we can get into this state. Well, I don't know if all of us know. Some of us know how we can get into this state of feeling like we're not getting anywhere, we don't know what's going on, is this practice really worth it? You know, we all have our own things that we go through. But she was teaching us to look up amidst that, that these weren't really what was important, these states of mind, that just doing the practice and going on. And again, another time when I was, again, as a new monk, I think it was down in Berkeley when I was talking to her, I told her what I thought was the most important thing that was going on with me was that I thought that my deepest fear was that there was only darkness, that I felt lost, and that there might be just a negative emptiness and nothing. And I told her of these feelings that I had, and she said, "You're making a mountain out of a molehill." Now, that may seem unkind to someone who thought they were suffering deeply, which I did, of course, think it was unkind, that she just hadn't a clue what was going on with me. But later I saw how right she was. We take our emotions and our thoughts very seriously. We think that they're true, and that's who we are. And she was trying to point out, it's not really important, these feelings. Just let them go. Look up. And she would say to me and to others, "Man stands in his own shadow and wonders why it is dark, and only he can turn round." that we could do it. We could look up. And when someone was looking miserable, she'd say, cheer up, it may never happen. She said that over and over again, especially to me. But she also, although she could give some of us a very hard time, what we thought was a very hard time and sometimes unfair, she didn't judge us. There was no judgment there. And she talked about the eternal, the unborn, whatever name she used to call it, that it did not judge us, that we just judged ourselves. And in Roar the Tigress, Volume 2, there's a nice paragraph here where she talks about the importance of not judging yourself at the time of death. And she says, it's terribly important that a person should truly have faith in the unborn at the time of death. Because if they do, then they are not going to judge themselves. But some people still judge themselves. No, no, I've done too much. There's nothing I can do. Do you know Marlowe's Faust? Have you ever seen, there's a wonderful film of it done by the Oxford University Dramatic Society. Have you ever seen Marlowe's Faust? Very interesting. At the very end, as Faust is going down to hell, the angels are exhorting him, look up, look up. You don't need to go down there. And he says, I'm damned, I have to go. So he goes, and the angels are saying, he's mad. What's he doing this for? But he is the one that turned away. And Mephistopheles, in that particular version, is equally beautiful, in that when he is asked what it is like to be in hell, he says, to be in hell is to be cut off from God by one's own will, the willingness to cut oneself off. So nothing we have done, no mistakes that we have made will cut us off from the unborn. We still have the karma that we need to face, but we can always turn towards the unborn. And we don't need to judge ourselves so harshly. And this is something that I've learned over the years, is letting go of that harsh judgment. When I make a mistake to, and this has taken a long time, to look at it and realize that it does me no good to judge it harshly, that helps nobody, and that I just need to learn from it. I don't always succeed in this. During this retreat, while I've been trying to prepare my talk and reading about Reverend Master, I've been judging myself really harshly that I'm not doing as well as I could from what she taught. And so now getting to the point of doing this Dharma talk, I'm going to let go of that judgment at this point. But it does come up, even when we think we have let go of that. Now, as I said, she would point out our mistakes to us, and sometimes she did it in what may have seemed like a harsh and unkind way, sometimes in front of the whole community, and we used to call it being hit over the head with a 2x4. And one time I made a big mistake in my training, and she figuratively hit me over the head with a 2x4. And I know from what came next that was the only way that her teaching could get through to me at that time. I was so blinded by my karma that I just didn't get my mistake. I just didn't understand what I had done. So I asked her if I could go out to our hermitage, which was the Fugen Hermitage at that time, and she let me go. She sent me out there with another monk, so I wasn't there by myself. And I spent a lot of time meditating, reading, and asking for help. And I got it. It came through. I understood what I had done. I saw my lack of compassion, and I was sorry. And when I came back, and I think she was away that summer, and when she came back, nothing was specifically said. You know, I didn't tell her what I had seen. She didn't ask me. But from the way she treated me, I knew that she knew that I had seen. And the whole matter was completely dropped. So she didn't hold a grudge. When she saw that you had gotten it, she let it go. And I'd like to give you two examples of my really knowing her compassionate heart. These two examples meant a lot to me. They were just simple things. One was, see if I can find it. Okay. When I first came here, I was the laundry monk for a number of years, and then I was the infirmarian, the nurse here, because I had a nursing degree, and although I hadn't really practiced medical nursing, I'd only done some psychiatric nursing after graduation, and I didn't know anything really very much about how to practice nursing. She made me the nurse, and I had to learn everything on the job. And I think it was in 1986 when one of our monks was dying from a recurrence of cancer. Another monk who was experienced in nursing and I were looking after her. And on the night that she died, that she was dying, she kept asking for a bedpan. And when I finally was trying to get it under her, I was very awkward. I didn't have much confidence in myself. And she died during my attempt. And I was convinced that I had died, that I had caused her to die prematurely. And what I considered, from my own judgment, wasn't that great of a state of mind for her. You know, I had these ideas that she had to be, you know, completely peaceful and and she wasn't at that moment. So I felt just really awful. And the other nurse who was with me, who had a lot of experience, you know, reassured me that this is what happens when someone dies. They ask for the bedpan, that she was just dying, which of course helped. But during her funeral ceremony, as we were circumambulating around this hall, Reverend Master came up to me, took my hands in hers, and said, "You have done nothing wrong." It's hard for me to describe what that was like, but it was coming from a very deep place, and it really had an effect on me. I felt her compassionate heart. The other time was... Well, first let me say this, that in the summer, as you all know, in the summer of 1976, Reverend Master was very ill and was staying at the Berkeley Priory. Reverend Master was the prior there. She cut herself loose from Shasta Abbey, and we didn't know if she would ever come back. And that's when her third Kensho began. And in the fall, she returned to Shasta Abbey, and it continued up here. And for those of you who were here, you know that that was a very interesting time. She told us about past life karma. She introduced us to mudras, what we called mudras or flows, which was a form of Jinchen, to help us with past life karma and to help remove blockages. And she was continuously giving us the teaching of her Kensho experience. Some of the monks were scared by all that was going on, and some thought she was corrupting the teaching and left, I think, which was very hard on her. But for me, I was relieved when I heard about past life karma, because for me it explained why I was as I was. I just could not figure it out, why I was as I was, why I had certain tendencies, why I had certain thoughts and feelings. And this really explained a lot to me. And so we all started doing mudras on each other. And one time when a couple of monks were helping me with a mudra at her house, she sensed that I needed help and came out of her room. And from the past life that was coming up came the words, which I said, "You say you love me, but you really hate me." And she said to me in her strong and certain voice, "I guarantee that you are loved." And this this came for me straight from the eternal, straight from her, you know, the compassion, her compassionate heart, which was the same compassionate heart of the eternal and of the Buddhas and ancestors. In recent years, when I was doing a retreat at Compassionate Friend Hermitage, and something difficult was arising, I heard these same words loud and clear, as though it was coming from her again, coming from the unborn, and it had the same impact as it did the first time. So her teaching continues, her transmission continues. She transmitted to all of us who were around her all of her teaching. And it continues within us and within you. And Reverend Master would often say that she wasn't the one in charge of things. It was the Buddhas and ancestors. And in preparing for this talk, I read through How to Grow a Lotus Blossom and sections of Roar of the Tigress, Volume 2. And one of the things that came through for me in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom was her humility. That the teachings that she was offering was what she learned from what was being given to her during the Kensho. She wasn't saying, you know, "I learned this, I'm the great teacher," but she was very humble in what she was learning from the unborn and what she was offering to us. It was coming from something bigger. And she talked about that this Kensho was possible because she was willing to give up everything and to give everything. But she also didn't doubt that we could also do this. I'd like to read some sections from How to Grow a Lotus Blossom and Roar of the Tigress. When I first read, or some of the times that I read How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, what struck me was, I could never do this. You know, this is, how did she have the courage, the willingness, you know, to face all these fears, all these difficulties? However, when I was reading it again recently, what struck me was how she was actually helped by the eternal the whole time. And this is something that I have noticed in my practice, that when I need it, I'm given the help that I need. And during this Kensho, she was always being given the help that she needed to be able to go on. She was being given teaching. She was being nudged. And so I just like to read a few things in from How to Grow Lotus Blossom and from Roar the Tigress to show how she was always being helped and how I hope that you understand that we're all being helped. And when we do the training, when we're open to this help, we can see it. And I have also found when that I'm getting off the track, I'm also nudged back if I'm willing to accept the teaching that I'm given. So I'd like to read from Plate 2 of How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, Scaling the Glass Mountain. There is nothing for it but to go straight up the face. How do I climb that which is sheer and glassy? By going straight up. By not thinking whether I will live or die. By not thinking I am inadequate or adequate, male or female. Maleness and femaleness cannot help me here. Here the world of the opposite ceases. There is no way up for one who is stuck in inadequacy or adequacy. Up and up and up, without ever doubting my ability, without looking down, without thinking, without caring about the lightning that comes from the storms, without fearing the ferocious animals that I may meet, without worrying about the darkness or the avalanches, holding fast to the memory of the Kensho, up, up, and on. Will the climb to the top never cease, never end? Perhaps everyone else was right, perhaps to go off into despair, but I know this is wrong and will not listen to the voice that whispers, go back, you are too weak, you cannot do it, you have not been good enough to climb this mountain, you have not done enough to train yourself. You do not know how to climb. And I say, quiet, I can climb and I will. And this is it's very interesting because throughout How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, when she sees something that seems impossible to do in her visions, and she just does it anyway, something, it happens. It's somehow made possible. And I was just thinking that this is kind of the koan of the goose is out. How does the goose get out of the bottle? I think it's just our willingness to do what may seem impossible that allows the goose to be out. And in Roar the Tigress, Volume 2, in the section on the great ocean of meditation, she actually talks about what allowed this Kensho to happen. And she also talks about, in a different way, how the Eternal is helping us all the time. But first of all, I'd like to read just a section on the great ocean, a little bit about what she says about the great ocean of meditation. The great ocean of meditation is the essence from which they, she's talking about the Buddhas and ancestors, and we come and go. It is the energy of which we are composed. Appearance and disappearance, arising and vanishing, are but dreams. They are but phenomena in time as we think of it. They are nothing more than that. The real essence has no time. The great ocean just is, which is why it is in a state of meditation, and why it does not get upset by all our twists and turns and twiddles, and why it cannot be bound by the sorts of moral codes that we put upon ourselves. We cannot conceive of a moral code so high that it can encompass the entire universe and yet tolerate the twists and turns of each and every one of us. But that is just what the essence of the precepts, which is the essence of the great ocean of meditation, is. And now she talks about what allowed her Kensho to begin. If I were asked, what was the one thing that caused more people to come to realization than any other, I would say it was the teaching of perceptual truth. We hear of all the koans and how stones hit bamboo, how somebody stubbed his toe, etc. You hear all of this, but what was it that set the thing going in the first place, so that suddenly something could act as a catalyst? There is a verse in the Shishogi which says, whenever these precepts are truly accepted, Buddhahood is reached. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven into enlightenment. That verse was the catalyst that projected me into the third Kensho. But what would have happened if I had not been studying the ten precepts themselves in detail prior to that? The verse could not have been a catalyst. It would have had no meaning. What caused me to take up this detailed studying of the precepts at that point in my life? The fact that I was up to certain things, that something in me kept saying, you shouldn't do that. What was it in me that kept saying you shouldn't do that, other than a trickle of the great ocean of meditation? Buddha begets Buddha in more ways than one. The catalyst is only a catalyst. It's a stone hitting a bamboo or a toe that gets stubbed. And this suddenly sort of jolts something out off the shelf or lines up a bunch of poles in one line, or whatever way you like to look at it. But it is that tiny little voice, that tiny little drop of the great ocean samadhi, which gets the thing going. Through all the many twists and turns that enlightenment uses to find itself within our lives, these are, each and every one, its trickles. You know how on a muddy road out there, you sometimes see a tiny little trickle of water coming down. And just that tiny little spot is not dust or mud. And everything around it seems to dry up quickly. But yet that little trickle of water somehow still keeps running. That's how this is. Because we are honestly trying to train, a little trickle from the great ocean of meditation runs throughout one's life. By looking at it from the back end, as it were, after realization has taken place, you can see where the trickle has been. Anytime there is a trickle, and you see the possibility of going deeper in your training or taking meditation and the precepts more fully into yourself, go with it. Because this is what eventually creates the situation in which all conditions are ripe for a catalyst to do its work. It is going with a trickle that makes this happen. Do not go around looking for more and better catalysts. Any catalyst will do when all conditions are ripe. Now, I love this part where it says that through all the many twists and turns that enlightenment uses it to find itself within our lives, that it's not just us looking for the unborn, it's the unborn looking for us. And she says, I think in this chapter, that when we sit down to meditate, we're beckoning to the unborn, and the unborn is beckoning to us. Because it's our true nature. The last thing I wanted to talk about was her death, her entry into eternal meditation, and what happened at the time of her death. For me, anyway. It was in 1996, in November of 1996, and I think we all knew that she could die at any time. But when the call came through, it was actually an intercom call, that she had died, it was, for me, I wrote down, it was a shock. But pretty soon, I felt this joy. And I asked another monk, and finally I had the courage, I thought I should be feeling this deep grief, which I know some people felt. I felt kind of embarrassed that I was just feeling joy. And I talked to another monk, and she said, yeah, I am too. And there was just this joy and peace, this very great peace that filled the monastery for 2 weeks. This is what I sensed. And I also sensed that the Buddhas and ancestors were there, perhaps welcoming her, perhaps just protecting us during these 2 weeks. But it was an incredible time. And I think everybody who was here felt something of this. And sitting with her, when I meditated with her a few times, I felt this great peace and joy. And what I also noticed, we had a lot of monks coming here from Throssel and from other priories, and everyone worked harmoniously. And at the ceremonies, all the funeral ceremonies, I just there was this love and joy and peace. It was remarkable. And I wrote an article for the memorial issue of the journal for her. And I wrote this. On the evening before the burial, we did three ceremonies. One was the Dharma ceremony. It was very similar to the abbess's or abbot's Dharma ceremony, in which each monk goes up in reverse seniority order and ask the abbess or abbot his or her spiritual question. For this ceremony, Reverend Master's empty chair was placed in front of the main altar, and we each went up and asked our question in silence. I realized that all these years, Reverend Master had been telling me in different ways to look up, and out of feelings of unworthiness and fear, I hadn't done this too successfully. I said this to Reverend Master, and that I now wished to look up into her loving eyes. The next day in my heart, I heard the answer, that I could look up whenever I wanted to. It was up to me. And then I wrote what was the dedication for the closing ceremony, which one of the priests, one of the monks, read at that ceremony. We offer the merits of this ceremony to the great priest Ho'un Jiyu. As we say goodbye to you today, we thank you for the great kindness you have shown to us, and I pray that we may be able to pass it on, each of us in our own way. We will guard and protect this temple and your teaching. May we strive to meet you face to face in the future by realizing our true nature, which is your true body. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds. Homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds. Homage to the scripture of great wisdom.